Catskills Liberty Studios. I will see you there.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Local Edition on a Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll talk with author and journalist David Levine about the role the Hudson Valley played in shaping the American Revolution. But first, on the phone with us now is the one and only Chris Rowley from the Shuwancock Journal, letting us know what's happening in Ellenville and Ulster County. Chris, let's talk about actually something happening in Sullivan County. There's a public hearing scheduled for September 15th. The town of Mamikating is considering a moratorium on data centers. What can you tell us?
Mamikating is going to have a hearing on setting a moratorium on, guess what, data centers. New York State, at the legislative level, has already approved a one-year freeze on data centers, and other towns already have that as well, like Wawarsing. Data centers are the new kind of thing that NIMBY doesn't want, and I can perfectly understand it, because data centers, as they are now configured, are essentially large metal sheds full of computers, servers, little flat ones that go in racks, floor to ceiling. So you might have, 20,000 of them inside this big building. And they all are cooled by an immense, a plethora of little fans. And one or two of them you wouldn't notice. But once you get up to like 40,000 fans, it produces a kind of a high-pitched, endless whirring noise that nothing can really stop getting out. And it goes on 24/7. And
I see the videos online of folks, recording data centers outside and, with decibel meters. And it's just loud. Like you say, it sounds like fans going on 24 hours a day. And these fans are, needed because they have to cool all these computers down.
Right. I mean, my favorite analogy these days is imagine that cicadas the size of trains set up in the woods near your house and just did their thing. You'd go crazy. And that's what it's doing to people. It drives them mad. And the sound can travel up to a mile.
Wow.
And of course, at night, which it doesn't stop. It goes on right through the night. Hey, at night, noise travels.
Was there an actual application put in for data center, or they're just doing this just trying to get ahead of the game?
No, a local resident was quoted saying, basically, I'm seeing some proactive response to what's going on in Sullivan County in general. But basically, it's not. No, they don't seem to have had any applications yet, but they know that they could come in at any time.
Yeah.
So to chill that, have a moratorium while they study it and see what they can do. And remember, New York State has already put a clamp as well. But it's just to be on the right side of the issue. And it's an issue that will concern everybody. And the next one, now they've done that, if they're following Wawarsing, they'll be looking to have a moratorium on battery centers as well.
For batteries, that's the only application I know of in Sullivan County that's going on. There's a large, one of the county's largest solar farms going to come, is pushing through the planning process right now in town of Thompson and Forsberg, 1,200 acres of solar panels and also a battery storage field facility.
AI world that is apparently coming, whether we like it or not, it's going to happen. There's going to be a vast increase in battery storage and a vast increase of data processing, and that will be data centers.
Yeah.
So this is what we're going to deal with. And municipalities now have the option of creating these moratoriums to give them the time to get up to speed on what this could mean. Then they can maybe come up with things to protect themselves from it, to deny it, prevent it.
Well, Chris, we have to leave it there. Please keep us updated on this moratorium. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Local Edition on a Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Next up, we'll talk about how the Hudson Valley was a factor in the American Revolution. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
In 1987,
Ms. Magazine includes Dolly Parton as one of its Women of the Year, and Gloria Steinem herself writes this tribute to Dolly Parton. It starts like this. People who haven't listened to Dolly Parton or feminism may be surprised to learn that they go together.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Welcome back to the Local Edition. It's Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo.
United States, it's marking 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. When we tell the story of American Revolution, we often focus on places like Boston, Philadelphia, and Yorktown. But the Hudson Valley also played a central role in the fight for independence. Control of the Hudson River could have determined whether the colonies remained united or were divided by British forces. David Levine recently explored that history in his Times Union article, How the Hudson Valley Made America. He is also the author of The Hudson Valley, The First 250 Million Years. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So in reading your article, you know, you say that America was conceived in Boston, born in Philadelphia, but gestated in the Hudson Valley. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that the baby was formed mostly in New York State and mostly around the Hudson Valley. A third of all the battles that were fought during the Revolution were in New York. Most of them, if not all of them, were about control of the Hudson River. The Hudson River was the key dividing point between the northern colonies, mainly Massachusetts, and the southern colonies. And in those days, when travel was limited to boats, controlling waterways was the key to victory in most conflicts. So both sides knew right away that the war would be won or lost by whoever controlled the Hudson River.
What do you think would happen if the British have gained complete control of the river?
Well, I've talked to historians who said an American victory would have been unlikely. Mm. The idea for the British was by controlling the river, they would separate the northern colonies and the southern colonies, sort of cutting the head off from the body. Most of the political will for the revolution came from New England, of course, but most of the citizenry came from the mid-Atlantic and southern colonies. So there needed to be a coordinated effort. And if the British could separate those two, they had a distinct advantage in winning war.
Yeah. And let's talk about the sort of the geography of the Hudson River and how that sort of shaped the way the war was fought, being
right
all the way from New York City all the way up.
Exactly. It was the only major waterway that went all the way from New York City to Canada, essentially. The river doesn't go all the way to Canada, but it was very easy to get from the river to the Champlain River, to the Champlain, Lake Champlain, and then up to Canada, which was held by the British. So you control that waterway, the British have everything they need from New York and, therefore the ocean. The U.S. did not have a navy, so the British certainly would control the waterways out in the ocean. And if they controlled the river as well, they effectively separated the coming, the United Colonies in half. So the river was the only way they could really do that. The Hudson, and it's just a fluke of geography. Could have been anywhere else. It just happened to be the Hudson River, which at that point they called the North River, because it went all the way north to Canada.
Right, right. Now, you talked about also sort of the American victory at Saratoga. Why was that such a turning point in this war?
Oh, that was the first big battle that the colonial forces won. So not only was it devastating in itself, it convinced France that they could back a winner. The emerging U.S. would never have won the war alone. They needed the French help. And the French were reluctant because, even though they hated the British too, as everybody did, everybody hated the British, they didn't want to get sucked into a war that they didn't have a good chance of winning. Once the colonial army, George Washington's army, beat the British at Saratoga and therefore pretty much secured the river, that wasn't the end of it, but that was a big part of it. The French said, okay, these upstarts have a good chance. We're going to get in. So they then came in on our side, supported us with money, with ships, with arms, with everything that we needed to finish the job. And I don't know if the U.S. would have finished the job without the French help.
you mentioned Benedict Arnold, who was a hero at Saratoga, before being known as a traitor. How we should look at his, you know, his, I guess, complicated role in the region's history?
Well, it is complicated because he was both a hero and a traitor. He was instrumental in battles in both Canada and Saratoga. But he was a difficult figure, to say the least. He was very money hungry. And it's worth noting that the way the British, what the British wanted to exploit was West Point, as we all know, that Benedict Arnold was going to sell them the plans to West Point. The reason the British wanted West Point was to get the river. At that point, George Washington had established a chain across the Hudson Valley, across the Hudson River. One of his great tactics was to block ships moving up and down the river, and they did that by building this massive iron chain that they literally stretched from shore to shore near West Point. And the fort at West Point, which at that point was not really that big a fort, it was up on the highlands to protect the chain. So the reason the British wanted the plans to the fort was that they could take over the fort and then pull the chain out of the river, and then they would regain control of the river. So that was the whole reason behind getting Benedict Arnold on board. It wasn't West Point, it was the river. And that, again, signifies the importance of the Hudson River to winning or losing the revolution.
Does anything remain from that chain?
There are a few links left, yes. Yeah. West Point, there are a couple of them on display. And a few other places, the Albany Institute of History and Art has one, a couple of other places. But mostly at the end of the war, it was just kind of left to rot on the shore. A few smart people at the time decided that maybe it was worth preserving. The best, probably, if you want to go see them, visit West Point. They're on display right alongside the river, and you know they mark the history of it as well. So they're pretty cool. They're huge. They're like, you know, I don't know what that is, 3 or 4 feet long, oval links, made out of forged iron, which in itself is a great story. They had to forge this iron in secret because the British had forbidden any iron making in the colonies. So they hid in the forests, mainly Sherwood Forest, and they had these hidden kiln forges where they made these links and they dragged them up through the snow, put them together, and pulled them across the river. Wow. So that's another sort of very interesting sidebar story that a lot of people don't really appreciate.
I've been to West Point as a kid. I'm trying to remember if I saw it, because I'm sure during the tour they pointed it out. But I
they probably did, but maybe not. Yeah. So go back.
It's a good reason to go back. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So like the Hudson Valley, you know, and you mentioned that it was not only a sort of a military center, but in 1777, New York's first state constitution was adopted in Kingston, and the state's first government met there. Why was Kingston chosen?
Again, the river. Yeah. In that time period, you know, we forget with all our modes of transportation that back then the boats was the only way to get long distances. So the river was central to, that's why big cities are all on the rivers. You know, they had to get in and out. So the river has always been central to New York State's history. All the capitals from New York City to Kingston to Albany, they're on the river, and it's not by accident. It's because the river is key to New York State's power. In fact, the river and then the Erie Canal, which connected the river to the lakes, again, water travel is what made New York State so powerful.
Right. And also, you mentioned that, you know, after the victory at Yorktown, George Washington established his headquarters in Newburgh, where he suggested that he become something like an American king. You know, we celebrate 250 years. We're known for the transition of power from one president to another, and that the importance of not having a king. Why was that decision so important to the country's future?
Because for that very reason, George Washington could have been de facto king. Plenty of people wanted him to be. I mean, we have to remember that this was a whole new concept, this whole thing called democracy and self-government, never been done before. Nobody had ever been controlled by anything other than a king or some kind of dictator. So they really didn't know what that meant. George Washington did, and the founding fathers did. They knew that transfer of power was the key to a democratic government. And George Washington, many people think the greatest thing George Washington ever did was resign the presidency. We have certain people now in power who don't want to resign the presidency. And that's the difference between a democracy and a dictatorship or a kingdom. Yeah. So that's why it's important. We are where we are because of the transfer of power, the peaceful transfer of power.
I often wonder what would happen if George Washington, you know, took on the suggestion to become king. What would life be like now?
It's hard to know. We'd probably be just sort of England Jr. Yeah. You know, it means the revolution really wouldn't have mounted to much.
Right.
So maybe he would have been a benevolent king, but somebody would have come along who was not a benevolent king, and we'd be right back where we were.
Yeah, and then have these, you know, just being stayed in one family for centuries and centuries.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. That's what makes America different. And that idea spread to the parts of the rest of the world. So that's the genius of the founding fathers and what they created. The problem is it's tenuous and it's fragile and it takes work. And we've learned in the last 10 years that it's easily disrupted and possibly destroyed. So it takes vigilance and work. It's not self-sustaining. It has to be upheld with hard work. Somebody once said democracy is not a noun, it's a verb. And it has to be an active process.
I want to talk about your book a little bit here. Your book, The Hudson Valley, the First 250 Million Years, which begins, you know, long before the revolution, of course, with dinosaurs, glaciers, and regions, you know, first indigenous peoples. You know, how much did that longer history sort of shape the Hudson Valley that the revolutionary forces encountered? You know, the shaping of the river, the shaping of the mountains that we have here.
Yeah, well, it all starts with geography. The dinosaurs are way before New York was New York, of course, but the glaciers are really why New York State and the Hudson River Valley are what we are. It's why the whole valley was carved out by the glaciers, the whole Northeast, essentially. We were very lucky in that we got left this river and these mountains and these beautiful scenery. Not that we're the only one. Massachusetts and New England, of course, are also beautiful, but we got this river. A lot of it is because of the glaciers. So it starts there. That also brought the first indigenous peoples here because, again, water was key. So they were searching for fresh water, and they found the Hudson Valley and became a beautiful place for them to live for many thousands of years. And then, of course, the Europeans came over and said, we want this, and terribly kicked out the Indians and murdered them, but took it over. So it's really an accident, a lucky accident of geography. Same reason that the Erie Canal was built here. A lucky accident of geography created an opening in the Appalachian Mountains through where the Mohawk River is. So it was really the only place on the eastern seaboard where you could get from the East Coast through the mountains to the West. And the Erie Canal was the first one to exploit that. And that helped make New York, again, a prosperous business state because it opened up the West. And actually, it opened up Europe, too. It was just easier for goods to travel through New York State than anywhere else in the country.
In your book, you describe it as both chronological and personal. Why was it important to you to include your own experiences along the region's history?
Well, so my book is not a solid history. I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist. And this book is a collection of articles I did mostly for Hudson Valley Magazine many years ago that were collected into book form. And some of them were my experiences of the Hudson Valley. Instead of just straight history or straight journalism, it's also kind of my personal journey. I was not born in the Hudson Valley. I came here, you know, in my 30s and got to experience this with new eyes. And I thought a couple of my essays, you know, were sort of helpful in that way. It's not just descriptions of the history, but it's also like the personal experience. Like, for instance, there's a story about the walkway over the Hudson. I did a story about that, taking a walk over it while suffering from a fear of heights. Yeah. And, so I thought it was sort of a funny and interesting, different way to show what the walkway over the Hudson is about for those of us who may not appreciate it as much as some of you other landlubbers. So it's things like that, but it's mostly journalistic portrayal of the history of the valley from, like you said, from when the dinosaurs were here through the glaciers, through the first indigenous peoples, through the coming of African Americans, the Dutch, all the way up to the building of the New York State Thruway, the walkway over the Hudson, And it's all in a journalistic sort of magazine style. It's not a dry textbook history. It's meant to be read in quick snippets. You'll learn a lot. I interview people who know more than I do. But then I try to write it in a fresh and sort of lively magazine style format. It's funny when it's appropriate. It's serious when it needs to be serious. And you can pick and choose if you're interested in this topic or that topic. You can bounce around. Or you can read it straight through from beginning to end. It's mostly chronological, but not entirely. Right. So, you know, you can just sort of have a fun time flipping through it and finding a story you like to read and read more about it if you're interested.
Right. And you know, just going back on you know, the glaciers and the time before, you know, everything happened here, you know, those remnants are still around. Like if you don't go to Central Park, you see the, you know, the uproots of the bedrock, or you see these large rock masses that were sort of pushed by the glaciers and just left there. It's just amazing, right? that history exactly is around us still.
And the Hudson River School of Art, which is the first American form of art, was created in the Catskill Mountains at the Catterskill Falls when people like Thomas Cole and Frederick Church went into the mountains and painted these majestic natural scenes, all of which were thanks to the glacier. You know, all those waterfalls, all those mountains, everything in between were left for us to enjoy. And those artists were the first to enjoy it and take it to the rest of the world.
Yeah. So let's say if a person or a student is listening to this, you know, what is one Hudson Valley story that you believe every local student should learn?
Oh, boy, there's too many. That's the point. This is one of the richest historical areas in the whole country. It's the only area that really has 400 years of European history, because we have our Dutch history that the rest of the country pretty much doesn't have. It's not the first British colony, but it was among the first successful British colonies. Everything basically that happened in this country happened here probably first. The Native American Wars, I mean, you can argue that they happened in Massachusetts too, and then, you know, that's a strong argument. But Native American struggles, slavery, emancipation happened here before many other places. Technology, we were a leader in technology throughout the rest of the world. The Hudson Valley has everything. So there's no single story. I really think the best, and this is a plug, a shameless plug, but I think if you want to know a light but pretty expansive history of the Hudson Valley, start with my book. They're not deep in any way. I mean, you'll get a lot of basic information, but if there's one thing that sort of says, well, I want to know more about that, there's so much information. If you want to know about the history of the indigenous tribes, or you want to know our history of slavery, or, you know, even the history of the comedy of the Catskill Mountains, you know, light, heavy, in between, you'll get a good taste of it in my book. And then there are 100,000 other sources to learn more and find out more. So I'm dodging your question. I can't pick a single one.
Well, I'm just hearing you talk, I'm just interested. This has nothing to do with the Hudson Valley, but how did you get into journalism?
Oh, in college, I was an English major, and I did an internship at a local newspaper, and I thought, I like this, I could do this. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So I moved to New York City, and I worked in journalism there for many years. And then I moved up to the Albany area, and I've been a writer-editor ever since.
That's great. So, you know, in putting this book together and, you know, writing all these articles, and I guess also revisiting some of these articles that you know, you may have not looked at after a while, was there anything you sort of discovered while researching the article or articles or the book, putting it together, that surprised you?
Oh, a lot of things. But sort of the one I bring up the most when people ask me that is the story of Hudson, New York. I don't know if your readers know or your listeners know, Hudson, New York was built basically out of farmland to be a center of whaling in the early 19th century. Now, if you think about that, that makes no sense whatsoever. Hudson Valley or Hudson, New York is 100 miles from the ocean. There are no whales in the Hudson River. But during the War of 1812, the British cut off the whaling industry out of New England. And at that time, whaling industry was, if not the biggest, one of the biggest businesses in the world. So some of the whaling business people in Nantucket said, we got to find someplace else to go, because their ships were being blocked. So they searched the whole East Coast and came up the Hudson River and found this land in what became Hudson, New York. They bought it. They renamed it. They built a whole town strictly to be a whaling center. They built all the businesses that you needed to support, shipbuilding, rope building, whale blubber processing, bars, restaurants, you know, everything you needed. So it was built from the ground up to be a whaling center. That surprised me because, again, who would think you would have a whaling business 100 miles from the ocean?
Yeah. Well, David, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on you want folks to know about the history of the Hudson Valley and sort of how it shaped not only, you know, the rest of the Hudson River and how it shaped the rest of New York, but also the country, or anything about your book?
Well, I think the takeaway is that, and this was my takeaway, that there's so much history here that it's not taught well. We don't know it. Even people who've lived here their whole lives. I've done book talks and book presentations up and down the Hudson Valley for years. This book came out 5 years ago, and I've done all kinds of presentations. And even people who lived here their whole lives didn't know most of this stuff. It's been lost. So I think people who live here should appreciate how historic we are. If I always like to say, if the Hudson River was in Europe, it would draw tourists from around the world. Mm. It's beautiful. It's historic. It's everything you would want from an area. We have great food now. We didn't always have that, but thanks to the Culinary Institute and other sort of changes in culinary arts, we have great food. We have great wine. We have great beer. We have the arts. It's a fantastic place to live. And I wish people who live here appreciated it more and celebrated it more. And I think, to plug my book again, you might get a sense of that if you read my book. People say they really have learned so much and they find so many places that they want to go visit now that they sort of heard of, you know, yeah, maybe, but what is that? And once they read the book and they say, I have to go there. And they do. So it's also a travel guide. It's great for day trips. You know, we're also fortunate that we're, you know, the whole Hudson Valley is no more than, you know, 2 to 3 hours top to bottom. So right. You can do anything in a day. But you can also spend a weekend somewhere, find a cool town that you've never been to with a lot of history, Hudson, New York, for instance, spend a weekend there, see the shops, learn about the Whaling Center, go to Amana, learn about Frederick Church. And, you know, you've had a great day and a half, 2 day trip.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Okay. I think we should all enjoy where we live more than we do.
I totally agree. I love vacationing within New York just because it is such a beautiful place. I recently went on a vacation with my daughter and went to different places in New York, state that we haven't been to before. And a lot of times I took some back roads that I've never been through. Right. I don't know, it was because GPS just took me there for some reason. But I'm glad it did because it is such a... And driving, I just kept telling my daughter, look at that mountain. Look at that mountain peak. And mm-hmm. It's just such a beautiful area.
It is. And there's so many different types. You got the Adirondack Mountains. You got the Finger Lakes. I'm from Western New York, which has its own beauty. But, you know, the Hudson Valley really has everything you'll need. It's got mountains. It's got water. It's got culture. It's got nature. And it's within, you know, an hour or two drive. So you really, really can't lose going somewhere in the Hudson Valley and just seeing what you find.
Well, David, if people want to find more information about you or to purchase your book, where can they go?
So the book's available on most of the major websites. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I always encourage people to go to their local favorite independent bookstore. Please support your independent bookstore. If they don't have it in stock, they can certainly order it. So those are the best places to go. Some of the gift shops and some of the attractions around the Hudson Valley also have it in theirs. I never know who's got it in stock and who doesn't, but I know somebody was just at Dia Beacon and they saw it in a shop there. So, you know, if you're going to one of these locations, stop by the shop. It might be in there. And if not, encourage the shopkeeper to order it and put it on his shelf or her shelf.
Yes. Well, David, thank you so much for talking to us. We'll talk to David Levine. He's the author of The Hudson Valley, The First 250 Million Years, and he recently wrote a Times Union article entitled How the Hudson Valley Made America. So, David, thank you so much for joining us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been fun. I appreciate it.
And that does it for The Local Edition. Again, I've been your host, Patricio Robayo. We'll be back on Monday with Radio Chasco starting at 10 a.m. and The Local Edition starting at 6. Everyone enjoy Labor Day weekend. And don't forget, we have the Music Yard Sale on Saturday, September 5th, starting at 9 a.m., going all the way to 2 p.m. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
I'm Jason Tuga. On Friday nights, I make a mixtape from me to you. That's the mixtape coming up at 7, only on Radio Catskill.